Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Mubarak kept peace, maintained peace. He was a very balanced and stable man. When it changes, when we see the chaos in Egypt, we are afraid.
That was Zvi Mazel expressing his fear, former Israeli ambassador to Egypt, on All Things Considered this week. We will look now at the implications of the Egyptian revolution for both the Israelis and Palestinians, and we'll also do a whirlwind tour of other Mideast countries where the contagious protests might spread. With me are Shira Frankel, who reports from Jerusalem for McClatchy Newspapers and NPR. Hi, Shira. Hello from New York.
Hello.
And in our studio, Neil McFarquhar, UN correspondent for the New York Times, formerly their Mideast bureau chief based in Cairo from 2001 to 2006, and author of the book, The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah Wishes You a Happy Birthday, Unexpected Encounters in the Changing Middle East. Yes, that's the book title. Hello, Neil.
Hi. Good to be here.
Shira, your piece cited Israeli newspapers reporting that Prime Minister Netanyahu was asking the U.S. to support Mubarak at all costs. Is that your best understanding of the Israeli government position right now?
I think that that was the Israeli government's position at the beginning of the week. I do think over the course of the week, they've seen that that's very unrealistic. And I do think they've sort of maintained a quieter line in regards to the unfolding events in Egypt.
Netanyahu's public statement to the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, was that Israelis need to prepare for any outcome in Egypt, quote, by reinforcing the might of the state of Israel, unquote. Now, American politicians don't usually talk in terms of reinforcing our might. We say defense or something. Was Netanyahu referring to a new military buildup, or does that mean something else in the Israeli context?
Well, Israel's military is currently in a state of flux. There's a huge shift happening in terms of the head of the IDF, the head of military intelligence. I think Netanyahu was seeking to reinforce the Israeli public's sense of safety and security along the border. Whether that means a military buildup, whether that means Netanyahu putting his full backing behind whoever the next IDF chief of staff becomes, I think he was really just sort of trying to reassure the Israeli public with that statement.
And before we go to Neil, Israelis obviously have something to fear, since the Egyptian peace treaty is the cornerstone of its hopes for relations with the Arab world and the model for any land for peace deals. But are Israelis torn, from what you can tell as a reporter, at the thought of supporting a dictator rather than democracy as a matter of principle? Israel always promotes itself by saying it's the only democracy in the Middle East. That's for you, Shira.
Yeah. It was interesting. It was actually an aide to Netanyahu who told me that Israel would rather see an evil dictator in the Middle East than a leader that they couldn't predict or get a sense of his next move. I think that, you know, Israel often touts itself as the only democracy in the Middle East. But at the same time, it's important for Israel to be seen supporting other democracies, but more so to sort of be seen domestically, to be seen sort of enforcing its own security interests in the region.
Neil, what about the Palestinians? They've been pretty quiet. And I heard that the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah has called for new local elections, perhaps out of fear of revolt spreading there. Are the Palestinians unnerved by the protest movements?
I think everybody is unnerved by the protest movements because the sudden idea that all these police states are suddenly going to have to confront people power, it makes them nervous because they don't have, you know, solid credentials to fall back on. And so they're all trying to take, you know, whatever short-term measures they can that they think will diffuse some of this public anger.
What about the relative strength of the Palestinian Authority under Mahmoud Abbas versus the Gaza movement, Gaza government under Hamas? Is either strengthened vis-a-vis the other by all this?
They're both, you know, the it's the public, you know, that suddenly realizes in this case that they, you know, have the initiative. And I think that the Palestinian electorate, having had a choice in recent years, is a little bit, you know, less disenfranchised than the others around the region. But I think, you know, I mean, I don't think that the Gaza public exactly loves the rule of Hamas. Certainly not all of them. And so I think both of them are probably nervous. I mean, Hamas has sort of the Palestinian Authority under Mahmoud Abbas has been stalling holding elections because they're afraid every time they hold them they're going to lose a little bit of ground to Hamas. So perhaps if they do hold elections, you will see Hamas advance. But, you know, the other thing is that it's all a little bit unknown because people are in a surly mood and they want to fix a lot of the problems that they've been confronted with for, you know, a couple generations.
Shira, anything to add about the Palestinians and what's going on in Egypt from your perspective on the ground in Jerusalem?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that there's a big division about this, you know, in regards to Hamas and the Gaza Strip and, you know, Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas's movement in the West Bank. From my interviews in the West Bank, people are incredibly fearful of what's happening in Egypt. The Palestinian Authority, of course, relies heavily on Egypt when it comes to votes in the Arab League and general support across the Arab world. So a weakened Mubarak regime in Egypt it could be hugely detrimental to the Palestinian Authority and their ability to sort of express their interests across the region. Hamas, on the other hand, is hoping that whatever government comes next in Egypt will be favorable to them.
And listeners, we can take some phone calls if you consider yourselves a supporter of either the Israelis or the Palestinians in particular or close to those situations. Maybe you're Israeli yourself or Palestinian yourself. 212-433-WNYC as we talk for the moment about the democracy movement in Egypt and its ramifications for Israelis and Palestinians. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for Shira Frankel, McClatchy newspaper, special correspondent based in Jerusalem, who also files for NPR, and Neil McFarquhar, UN Bureau Chief for the New York Times, former Middle East Bureau Chief based in Cairo, and the author of The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah Wishes You a Happy Birthday, Unexpected Encounters in the Changing Middle East. So, Neil, what if we tweak the title slightly to read The Media Relations Department of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood Wishes You a Happy Birthday?
They are not quite so media savvy as Hezbollah often is. It's an interesting moment for the Brotherhood because they have a lot to gain, obviously, if the Egyptian political process opens up. But they're a very conservative bunch. They don't like to stick their head above the parapet before anybody else. And you know, the last time Egypt experienced anything close to open elections was 2005 when they won 88 seats in parliament, which is about a fifth. And they didn't do much. You know, they just kind of sat there and they did not agitate. And, you know, so they're always a bit of a cipher when it comes to what their political wants are.
Is it because they know that they're really under Mubarak's autocratic rule and so they have to stay relatively tame as an Islamist movement there, and that in a democratic, more freewheeling situation, their radical side might come out or radical elements from within them might rise to the top?
Part of that is that, you know, they are always under intensive, they're always being jailed and investigated and thrown into jail, in and out of jail. And so they're nervous about that. But also, it's a mistake to say the Muslim Brotherhood like it's a monolithic organization, because there are big differences within it and a big generational differences. You know, the movement now, there's sort of a board of governors, and a lot of them are in their 70s and 80s, and they sort of, were schooled in the Nasser era when a lot of them were tortured and a lot of them were thrown into jail. So they became very quiet and scarred by that. And then you have the next generation that grew up under Sadat, and Sadat kind of used them as a counterweight to the leftists, so they were allowed to run in elections and they, you know, in the university campus and things like that. So that group in their 40s or 50s are kind of open minded, like elections, and then the next generation, again, torture, scarred, and they're a little bit secretive. And the generation now, I met some in 2008 that were blogging, and, you know, they were being told by the 80-year-old and 70-year-old to stop blogging because they were talking about the inner workings of the Muslim Brotherhood, and the senior leaders didn't want that written about, and they were blogging about movies, and the senior leaders didn't think that a Muslim brother should be talking about going to movies because the movies are probably forbidden anyway. So A, there's been a long history of there being secretive peace, so people don't know. And B, you don't quite know what faction is going to be dominant when it all comes out.
Joe in Queens, you're on WNYC. Thanks for calling, Joe.
Thank you. I'm a supporter of Israel, and I find that Israel's in a tough place because they, on the one hand, I'm sure they would love to have another free country and democratic country in the region, but they're stuck between that there really isn't, if Mubarak falls, I don't think they're going to have that type of freedom that you're going to have. Because what you have is the mechanisms of democracy, but you don't have actual democracy where you have different voices and different choices. You'll have, you know, the autocratic government groups on the one hand, and then you'll have, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood, who's the only real viable other choice. And so you're stuck between theocracy and kleptocracy, and you don't have a real choice, a real democracy where people have the free ideas and the ability to choose something that really represents them.
Joe, thank you. Well, do you think that that's really going to be the choice, Neil, in Cairo, from your experience there?
I mean, I think that, you know, the military is going to ride herd on this change as much as they can. And, you know, we haven't, the demonstrations so far have not been about the relationship with Israel and the peace process. So I think the military believes in the peace treaty, and as long as the military is in the driving seat, that peace treaty is going to be maintained. On the other side of the form, you know, it's often said that Israel is very good about figuring out its security tomorrow, but they're not so good on the day after tomorrow. And their strongest insurance policy for security in the region is forming a peace with the Palestinians, because if you have a strong Palestinian middle class that has a peace treaty and believes in it, they're going to support it. And it doesn't matter what the Egyptians say or the Lebanese say or the Iranians say. The Palestinians are going to say, we have a peace treaty and we like it. So they should try and negotiate an agreement while they have, you know, people to talk to.
Shira, in Jerusalem, you reported that there's some egg on Israeli intelligence's face for having failed to foresee this. Is there intelligence from Israel now about how likely they believe it to be that either the Muslim Brotherhood would come to control foreign policy or that Egypt would cancel the peace treaty with Egypt, with Israel?
You know, I think everyone in Israel is looking into their crystal ball at the moment and trying to predict what's going to happen next. Unfortunately, those predictions are incredibly varied. And, you know, while you'll have one sort of military intelligence expert getting up in front of the cameras and stating definitively that the Muslim Brotherhood will cancel any peace treaty with Israel, you'll have another coming up 5 minutes behind him saying that, you know, quite the reverse will happen. I think the Israeli government is currently preparing itself for any eventuality, but as you often see with Israel, they tend to prepare for the worst case scenario.
Daoud in Patterson, you're on WNYC. Thanks for calling, Daoud.
Hi, Brian. I just wanted to say that I think that with this situation, with the inevitable departure of Mubarak, I think that what's going to happen is that this is going to force the Israeli side to basically negotiate in more good fashion, because basically what's happening is that the situation where has evolved where they're comfortable with the status quo. This is why you see all these quotes coming out of Israel, how they're watching it very closely and how they want to make sure, or they wish that the United States would support them. I think that, number one, with the situation in Gaza, this is going to cause some change, because then that's another hole in the siege of Gaza. So all this is going to contribute, I think, to speeding up the peace process.
That's interesting. Daoud, thank you very much. And Neil McFarquhar, you know, New York Times foreign affairs columnist Thomas Friedman wrote the other day that now would be an opportune moment for President Obama to put his own Mideast peace plan on the table with specifics and demand that Israelis and Palestinians negotiate with no preconditions. Do you think they're deliberating such a move at the White House?
I think they probably have their hands full in trying to figure out what's going to happen with the future of the government in Cairo. But it would seem that in a period of transition like this, when both the Israelis and the Palestinians are nervous about what's coming next in Cairo, it might be a good time to sit down and do some real hard bargaining instead of talking past each other like they so often do.
Shira, what do you think? We so often hear this Egypt situation being reported in terms of how it closes doors on the peace process. Tom Friedman is taking that alternative perspective and saying no, it opens an opportunity for Obama to put a peace plan on the table with specifics and demand that both sides negotiate. What do you think?
I have to be honest, I just can't see that as realistic at the moment, given where the Palestinian government currently finds itself. And Egypt was the party that was negotiating between the Palestinian government in Ramallah and Hamas in the Gaza Strip. And most people who are involved with the peace process between the Israelis and Palestinians will tell you that the Palestinians need to solve their own internal problems before a far-reaching, conclusive peace deal can be reached between, you know, the Israelis and the Palestinians. Given that Egypt is now not a player and that Hamas is probably biding its time to find out what the next government in Egypt will look like for them, I just can't imagine that the situation, sort of the facts on the ground being what they are, the situation is ripe for America to really advance any sort of real peace agenda here.
Here is a Palestinian in Brooklyn who was visiting family in Ramallah. Iman, thank you so much for calling in. Hello.
Hi. I listen to both sides, and, you know, before I visited my family, I was all for all the time, like, you know, we can work it out, it's peaceful, but then once I visited and, you know, was traveling to the border, just sort of traveling as a tourist, and had M16s in my face and got strip searched at the airport, just because I was a Palestinian, like, that made me feel so degraded and disgusting. And, you know, my last name's Ramawi, so there's a town, Be'erima, with all the Ramawis in Palestine, so they know who I am. You know, they know that I'm a Palestinian no matter what. I'm part black, too, so I kind of get it from both sides. And it's just like, you know, after feeling like just like basically a nothing, you know, I see that the Israelis aren't trying to see our side. They don't want to, and not every Palestinian's a terrorist, and my family's just trying to live.
Iman, do you think that, just to keep this on point of what's happening now, do you think that the situation in Egypt will change anything for Israelis or Palestinians?
You know, I feel like it might give people a sense of hope, maybe, that if, you know, the Egyptians could rise up and take back their country, that maybe they can too. I believe in a peaceful way, though. I don't agree with them, you know, taking over journalists and beating them up or anything, but, like, I feel like it might give people a sense of hope that, like, maybe people power, like, I've been an organizer in New York for some time now, people power can help. People power can, you know, sort of help the government to see that, like, we're not just innocent bystanders. We're not just going to say, okay, we're going to let the politicians just do everything, because the politicians clearly aren't coming to an agreement, and maybe the people can come to a better agreement.
Iman, thank you so much. Now, listeners, a couple of things coming up with events in the Middle East still in flux. WNYC will again present special coverage from the BBC World Service all afternoon. Tune in this afternoon starting at 1 on AM 820 WNYC. And on Saturday and Sunday afternoon from 2 to 5 for special continuous BBC World Service coverage of events in Egypt. We also have a poll question on our politics website. It's afreecountry.org. Should the United States support democracy in Egypt, no matter how anti-U.S. a democratically elected government may be? Should the United States support democracy in Egypt, no matter how anti-U.S. a democratically elected government may be? Answer yes or no to that question, and join the conversation if you want at itsafreecountry.org. We're almost out of time with Shira Frankel, McClatchy newspaper special correspondent based in Jerusalem, who also files for NPR, and Neil McFarquhar, UN bureau chief for the New York Times, author of The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah, wishes you a happy birthday. So, Neil, from your international perch, I just want to do a whirlwind of other countries, like quick questions, quick answers.
Sure.
More protests coming today in Jordan. Do they want the king to relinquish control like Mubarak and move toward an elected leader?
They don't. He's not a beloved figure, but they don't usually identify the monarchy with their political problems. They usually identify the government. I think that anger will continue because reform also has been put on the shelf there. But I don't think they will identify it with King Abdullah.
Tomorrow is a scheduled so-called day of rage in Syria. unlike Jordan and Egypt, an anti-U.S. Ba'athist regime that helps fund Hamas and Hezbollah and is aligned with Iran. What do you think could happen in Syria?
Vicious police state, much worse. They've already been beating up people in advance of the planned protest. And, you know, there's a few governments in the area that would have no compunction about using all force from the start to tamp this out. And I think Syria would be one of those.
Shira, is Israel on the other side when it comes to protests in Syria? Like, they're afraid of protests in Egypt because Egypt has a peace treaty. And they want to encourage demonstrations in Syria?
You know, Israel's remained very quiet about the events in Jordan, Syria, Tunisia, Lebanon. And I think that at this point, Israel would just as likely encourage sort of quiet in the region and no demonstrations, regardless of what cause they were supporting.
How about Tunisia? It's fallen out of the news, Neil. What's happening there?
You know, part of the problem with this, and, you know, it's obviously a bigger problem in Egypt because it's a bigger and more important country, is just that what comes next, because they are kind of leaderless. These, you know, they're not identified with political parties. It wasn't the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt that was leading this, nor in Tunisia, and they don't know who the leadership's going to be. So, you know, Tunisia, you know, is the military going to step in? We don't know.
And Yemen. I read that the protesters there have rescinded their call for the strong man to resign.
Well, he, of course, came forward and said, you know, he wasn't going to run and he wasn't going to have his son run.
In the next election.
In the next election.
Wasn't good enough for the Mubaraks.
I'm sorry?
Wasn't good enough for the protesters in Egypt when the Mubaraks said they wouldn't run.
Well, I mean, they, you know, he said, I'm not going to run, but I'm going to sit here for 8 months. So they're, of course, worried that, you know, come July, thousands of paid protesters will run into the streets of Cairo demanding that Mubarak stay. And he'll say, look, I'm staying by popular acclaim. So they want to take advantage of their numbers while they have them.
And lastly, what about Hezbollah? Your book is called The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah Wishes You a Happy Birthday. They seem to have taken over through democratic means in Lebanon.
I'm not sure there's a question there, but I mean, Lebanon, just because of its terrible tribal politics, is always a little bit riven by one side or the other. And, you know, they have kind of a functioning democracy because no side can dominate.
Shira, last word.
You know, I think it's just sort of a very nervous time for the entire region, for all of the current governments. And given that Egypt is the cornerstone of Israel's peace policy in the entire region, Israel is probably the most nervous of them all. And I don't think it's something that's going to be cleared up or resolved in the coming days. I think it's going to be quite a long process.
Shira Frankel, McClatchy newspaper special correspondent, based in Jerusalem. She also files for NPR. Neil McFarquhar, UN Bureau Chief for the New York. Hey, whatever happened to the UN? This is a big international change. Neil, I don't hear any action from the United Nations.
Ban Ki-moon, who has a very low profile for a Secretary General, has been speaking out about it against the use of force and for resolving this peacefully. But in terms of the organization itself, you know, their sort of mantra is when it becomes a threat to international peace and security, they step in, and this is sort of seen as a domestic problem at this point.
And he is the author of The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah Wishes You a Happy Birthday. Thank you both very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, listeners, as the eyes of the world are trained on the pro-democracy uprisings in the Middle East, we are starting right now to gather lessons from those of you who've seen this kind of uprising firsthand from any country, in any country that you experienced it in firsthand. So call us up right now. If you have lived through revolution, Cuba 1959, South Africa 1990, that peaceful transition, Iran 1979, the Philippines 1986, Nicaragua 79, all of Eastern Europe 1989, wherever, we're going to take your phone calls right now and start a process that we're going to continue for a week, culminating with a special event in the Green Space a week from today. For your stories about being witness to a revolution or even a participant in a revolution, for you to offer advice to Egyptians and Tunisians, who we just heard have a leaderless revolution still at this point, things could go in so many different directions. So call us up. We hope to get a wide array of callers for the next few minutes, people from all over the world, if this works out, with your experience being witness to a revolution and what lessons you think it holds for the Egyptians and the Tunisians and anywhere else where this might spread. 212 833-WNYC, 212-433-9692. No more calls on Israelis and Palestinians. That's over, so stop calling on that. We want to gather the lessons from those of you who've seen a revolutionary uprising overthrowing a dictator, overthrowing a monarch, overthrowing an autocrat firsthand. Sometimes it turns out well. Sometimes it turns out badly. Sometimes it turns out like India under Gandhi. Sometimes it turns out like the Iran under the Ayatollah. We've been collecting your stories on our Politics Hub. It's a free country. You can post them there. But we want these calls on the air, too, from you online to start a conversation that we're going to have from now through next Friday on and off. So 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Here's a caller we had the other day, a woman named Sheba, who remembers the revolution in Iran.
You know, I was 8 when the revolution happened in Iran, and obviously lives were changed overnight. I just don't understand why everyone is so sure that this is not Iran 1979. It feels awfully the same, you know, roses being given to the army and the army, you know, being neutral and a transitional government. And it turned out in Iran it was, you know, Islamic Republic disguised under democracy. So I'm hopeful. I know these are two different countries. I'm very cautiously hopeful, but I'm also terrified that we're underestimating that this isn't something in disguise.
So that's Sheba from Connecticut, originally from Iran, calling the other day. How about for you? Were you there when the USSR fell around 1990, 1989? Were you there for Cuba, the Philippines, Nicaragua, South Africa, India? Call and tell us your lessons from the revolution in your family's lives and the lessons to apply to Egypt and any other country going through this turbulence right now. 212-433-WNYC. We'll take your calls right after this.